Tax havens are places with very low tax rates that enable multinational corporations and individuals to get around the law. These global havens have been responsible for depriving governments of billions of dollars in tax revenues. James Henry is an investigative economist and global justice fellow at Yale University. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him about the most recent investigation he's been involved in.
The latest investigation we've been doing is of a couple big Swiss banks. The top two banks in the country have merged. And
it doesn't have anything to do with the scandal that Credit Suisse had a few years ago.
Oh, yes. Well, we were deeply involved in that. Ralph Nader and I went to the Department of Labor in 2015. Credit Suisse had pled guilty to a corporate felony involving helping wealthy Americans take money out of the country. And under the provisions of the law, if you are advising U.S. pension funds, you have to declare any kind of conviction that you've had under U.S. law, and you're supposed to be ejected from the program for 10 years. But the Department of Labor has historically always given waivers to these big financial institutions that get convicted. And the two banks in question, UBS and Credit Suisse, the largest Swiss banks that are now merging, have accounted for about 14 of the 37 waivers that have been given historically by the Department of Labor. They have a virtually unblemished track record of giving waivers.
So is the Department of Labor one of those revolving door departments where people from the industry actually serve in the department? It doesn't seem like that department would be that way, but is it?
Yeah, I've been surprised. I mean, this was the Obama administration back then. We had a whole day-long hearing on Credit Suisse and talked about their criminal history, including their failure to their reneging on their agreement with Holocaust victims. We had several survivors come in and testify about Credit Suisse never paying them under the 1990 agreement that was supposed to compensate the Holocaust victims for the amount of money that Swiss banks stole. But, you know, though they went on and gave them a waiver that year, and as we warned, institutions that have a track record of sort of serial criminality are really not likely to survive. And indeed, just last year, Credit Suisse hit the wall. They nearly failed. And the Swiss authorities decided to merge them into the other big bank, which is almost easily equally
almost
criminal.
As bad.
And so right now, this very moment, we have a request for another public hearing. We've submitted a long comment letter. My international coalition, not only Nader, but also experts in Australia and Germany and South Africa and Kenya, who've seen Credit Suisse at work and UBS at work for decades, basically ripping off developing countries and making business out of taking the capital flight back home. We've seen this time and again. Now they're before the Department of Labor again with another request for a waiver. So this is this is like an ongoing soap opera, but it's an opportunity, one of the few you get in the U.S. Power system, to actually have public hearings about the behavior of these big financial institutions. So we will at least have this story will be told.
So if big corporations or wealthy individuals try to evade taxes by taking their money to, I don't know, Luxembourg or Bermuda or the Cayman Islands or one of those places, do the U.S. authorities go after them in a bigger way than with...
Well, they're supposed to, but basically the trend has been toward, you know, I would say a lack of enforcement. The IRS has cut its staff by about a third since 2012. There was a bill that Biden had passed to increase the resources so that the IRS could actually do more enforcement, including global enforcement. But generally speaking, you know, that's run into the Republican wall. And so they're really starved for resources. Secondly, a lot of this money is hard to trace. It's once it gets offshore, there's a lot of financial secrecy. And indeed, U.S. institutions have also become very secretive. I mean, one of the biggest recipients of dirty money is the United States, because we have financial secrecy just about as good as anything you can find in the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Jersey.
So the notion that tax havens are all offshore is really
Oh
false.
yeah, no, the tax havens of choice in many cases are ultimately, I mean, you have to go through, layers. There's about 141 jurisdictions that we consider to be financial secrecy jurisdictions in the world. When I started studying this topic back in the 1970s, there were 15. So this has exploded. Little companies, countries like, the Isle of Man and Mauritius getting into the business. But those are sort of the intermediate sort of stepping stones, the place that people really want to ultimately invest their money, the crooks of the world, the kleptocrats, the tax dodgers. It's a little bit like the Star Wars bar scene. If you remember the Star Wars movie, where all the crooks are sitting around the same basic facilities, making use of the same kinds of lawyers, the same lax regulation, the same low taxes. And ultimately, they want to get their money into a place with laws. So that's the irony. They want their investments protected. So they want to be in the United States. They want to be in Switzerland. They want to be in the UK. These are places that are, if you look at Transparency International's annual list of comparative corruption, places like Switzerland, the United States, and the UK are always way, we are way down the list in terms of corrupt places. You look at the African countries, they are the corruption. There's this notion of corruption being an indigenous characteristic. What we pointed out is that it's actually just the opposite. The enablers of this kind of kleptocratic system that we have are all first world countries. They're the ones with the banks and the law firms and the accounting firms that really make a business out of ripping off developing countries.
Do you have any idea, just looking at the US, how much revenue is lost because of these tax havens?
Well, if you divide it into a couple different categories, one is corporate tax dodging, and that has proliferated since the 1970s. A lot of companies like Apple, had set up a company in Ireland to receive something like 60% of their global profits, basically as a citizen of nowhere for tax purposes. So it was a clever instrument that allowed them to park all this money offshore tax-free for decades. They didn't bring the money back. They wouldn't pay taxes. So corporate tax dodging, we figure, is on the order of $200 to $300 billion a year of lost revenue just from big companies that are doing that kind of thing. On the individual side, the numbers are at least that high. We're figuring something like $50 to $60 trillion of offshore private wealth that is essentially not taxed. That would include the money that's owned, let's say in the United States by wealthy Russians who are not paying taxes here. So it's basically become a situation where more and more of the tax burden in the economy for unavoidable expenses like health and welfare and roads and policing and stuff like that are being borne by ordinary people, by the working class. We now have a regressive tax system in the world as a whole. And that's something that's a big reversal from when I first started working on this in the 70s. We had a progressive tax system, but that is pretty much out the window now.
So periodically laws are passed by Congress to stop this kind of practice and to rein in these people. So what's going on there?
Well, you have 2,500 tax lobbyists in Washington, and they're not working for me and you. And so you have an IRS code, which has now got 75,000 pages of regulations. It's basically a full employment program for lawyers. They've talked about a wealth tax as a possibility. I mean, I think that's a nice idea, kind of an armchair economics idea. In practice, it's very hard to tax wealth when you have, billionaires who have free range on the planet and they can kind of move their money easily from one place to another. So if you slapped a wealth tax on someone with, let's say, there are all kinds of valuation problems. How do you value a fellow's art collection? And the unrealized portion of wealth is probably most of the wealth that's out there. It's like a full employment program for lawyers to set up a wealth tax.
So if the plan put forth years ago by Steve Forbes or brought back in another form, maybe I think Jerry Brown said it, we need a flat tax. And The idea I got there was that they were going to eliminate all the tax laws and just have this one flat tax. And of course, it would be regressive, but the idea was to just simplify the system and make sure that people really did pay their taxes. What do you think
Well,
of
I
that?
think it's possible to do a much simpler kind of income tax. We have all the structures in place to do a reasonable income tax, but there are other kinds of taxes that I think are relatively simple to implement. For example, New York State, since 1905, surprisingly enough, a Republican governor back in 1905 was facing a budget deficit. And against the opposition of everyone on Wall Street, he enacted a 0.1% transactions tax on stock trades. And everyone predicted that the stock exchanges would move to New Jersey. Actually, nobody moved. The tax was very successful. It operated well for 75 years. And then finally, Governor Kerry, who was in the pocket of Wall Street, repealed it. He actually didn't repeal it. He rebated it. So since 1982, New York State, which is a host to the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ exchange, the two biggest exchanges in the world, has rebated to Wall Street, these, you know, sort of deserving poor on Wall Street, something like $500 billion that could have been saved by this tax. So we have a proposal now before the legislature, given the dire straits that New York City is in, to simply stop this rebate, to repeal this rebate of the 1905 tax. Well, of course, that would then clear the way for European exchanges and Asian exchanges to have similar kinds of financial transactions tax. And the whole thing could be a very good way of funding, say, climate change solutions. If we had a global financial transactions tax, that could easily raise $200, $300 billion a year without dropping a beat. I mean, it's a tiny tax per share of all the stock trade. There's something like $173 trillion. Of stock trades on the world's 85 stock exchanges now. So the idea of moving toward financial, you know, progressive sales taxes of various kinds is one alternative to the wealth tax. But I don't think there's any magic bullet here. It's a question of getting Congress to actually understand that we need better tax enforcement of existing tax laws. And there's some big obvious loopholes that can be fixed. And we can try some of these more innovative transactions-oriented taxes.
You mentioned in terms of government agencies or departments, the Department of Labor and the IRS. What about the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Commerce Department or the Treasury Department? What kind of role do they play in trying to stop?
Well, they can be very important. One of the important issues we face now is the emergence of crypto as an alternative. Just to step back, I mean, the way I got interested in the underground economy was back in the 70s, I noticed that there was something like four $100 bills per capita outstanding outside of banks and, you know, the United States, U.S. bills. And the question was, you know, where are they? Ordinary Americans, especially back then, did not walk around with four $100 bills in their pockets. They were barely seen. Now, I think the figure is closer to 35 $100 bills per capita. And most of that money, it turns out, is offshore. So if you're an Argentine or, you know, you have a weak currency of your own, you would hold dollars. Now, the importance of crypto is that it provides, if it were widely established and it became a competitor to the dollar, it would become another, you know, sort of reserve currency. It would become a way of sort of keeping your investments away from the IRS. Very hard to audit that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a whole issue now that the SEC has been involved in is how fast do they want to allow crypto? What are the constraints they're going to put on it? Basically, under Chairman Gensler, they've been fairly accommodating so far. Trump has said that if he's elected, he will open the door to crypto. Well, that's a sort of a license to for people to simply evade taxes. I mean, you have, you know, any
so is
number
crypto kind of like high tech where the legislators and the regulators still need to catch up with it? They don't really know what's going on.
You know, I just don't think they understand the implications of it for these issues that we're talking about here, because in terms of tax enforcement, if it becomes accessible to everyone and you can all have crypto wallets, Right now, you can't buy anything with crypto. It's pretty hard to, you know, to use it to do grocery shopping. But as it becomes more useful to people, and it becomes also a store of value, it could become sort of a real threat to the traditional role of the dollar in the world economy, and also a real headache for tax enforcement. So that's one aspect of this. U.S. Treasury gets involved in anti-money laundering. They have entities like FinCEN and the Sanctions Enforcement Office that's involved in cracking down on entities that are violating sanctions around the planet. But when you take a look at all those agencies the Treasury has to enforce the rules against money laundering and sanctions busting, they are basically being starved for funding. I mean, I think the total budget for all of that enforcement effort in economic crime is less than $1 billion a year, and it's been declining since 2013. So again, we're seeing example, just like the Department of Labor, they've also been starved for money in this enforcement effort with respect to pension funds. So, you know, when they go after big banks that are criminals, basically advising U.S. pension funds, they are quickly outgunned by the, you know, the Wall Street firms that are working for these big banks. And I think that's the real challenge. It isn't so much that we need more laws in the books. We need tougher enforcement.
Have you heard anything about that from the candidates for president? Well, you mentioned that Trump wants to open things up to crypto.
Well, I think, you know, there's a huge lobby behind all that, and you'll find quite a few people who have an interest to that in the Kamala Harris camp. Some people are well known, big contributors who are well known for being pro crypto. In general, I'd say Harris is running on a neoliberal economic program. She isn't really tackling any of these progressive issues that we're talking about here. So when it comes to matters like climate, what do you do about global warming? You know, one of the proposals has been to have a carbon dividend, which would be a carbon tax that would be
Kind of a
re-
Republican plan to begin with, right?
Well, no, I mean, a carbon tax is not a Republican plan. They haven't been,
Well, that's carbon trading.
no, carbon trading is something different.
Yeah.
Carbon trading is where you're allowed to pollute, but you
Yeah.
promise to clean up the Amazon.
Yeah,
The
right.
problem with carbon trading is enforcement. And we're talking about enforcement problems. You know, nobody goes down to the Amazon to see how many trees you actually planted. You know, it's a great big enforcement, practical enforcement problem. And so that's been a traditional problem with carbon trading. No, carbon taxes have been proposed by economists as their favorite solution to the problem that we don't pay enough for the gasoline that we're using to pollute the planet. And they propose carbon taxes. The problem
Rather
is,
than fining the company.
well, they could fine the companies, but you know, the carbon taxes, when you break down who's actually generating the carbon, Al Gore, one thing he did that was very useful was to put up a website called Carbon Trace and climatetrace.org. And he's gotten his own independent metrics for where all of the carbon that's being generated on the planet is coming from. And a lot of it turns out to be coming from a relatively small number of really big refineries on the planet. And the Permian Basin in Texas is huge. You know, so there's a wonderful global map of all these different pollution sources. My point is that a carbon tax would actually be pretty concentrated on some of these big polluters. I mean, most of the money would actually be collected from the major polluters there. But you'd also see some effect on gas prices. And so I think Harris has been reluctant to say, well, I'm in favor of $10 gas per gallon gas, you know, because we have to save the planet. There's a version of this in which ordinary people don't pay anything. They get a check in the mail at the end of the day. It's called the carbon dividend. So, you know, most people produce a lot less carbon than, you know, these big oil and gas companies. And so they would be net beneficiaries. But I haven't heard any politicians talking about, you know, the carbon dividend. When it comes to tax policy and progressive taxation, again, you know, when you're talking about raising taxes on some of the people that are big contributors, you are entering, you know, sort of the danger zone. from a political standpoint. So they're much more they're much more comfortable talking about the obvious defects in the Trump candidacy and, you know, issues like gender and, you know, women's rights and those things. And those are all legitimate concerns, obviously. But I think the basic point is that the progressive economic agenda that many of us were excited about with Sanders, to some extent, some of the other folks around him, has been lost in the shuffle here.
Are there any countries in the world that handle the tax haven issue better than the U.S.?
Well, it's been a kind of race to the bottom since the 70s, since Reagan and Thatcher.
Free trade agreements. Yeah.
Free trade agreements, but also on the tax front, you've had lower and lower corporate tax rates, the mechanisms for evasion that we've talked about here with the growth of the haven industry. It's basically been, the trend has been in the opposite direction. There have been some initiatives on the part of organizations like the OECD to reverse this. OECD is a coalition of rich countries that occasionally wakes up and says, hey, we can't cut taxes for the rich forever. So they've introduced, you know, some reforms like country by country reporting for corporations and some progress on declaring beneficial ownership so you know who owns what. But bottom line is I can't point to a single country. I mean, we just had a Labour government elected in the UK for the first time in 14 years. And so they hope to have a more progressive economic policy. But their basic problem they faced is that they inherited the consequences of 14 years of conservative government, which is an absolute mess. Huge deficits as far as the eye can see. Public sector has been completely mismanaged. You know, France, you had the left thought it won the election. And then Macron came along and appointed a fellow who's, you know, a member of the French Republican Party. And he's a bureaucrat and he's, you know, not as bad as Le Pen. And then in Germany, you've had, you know, the left has been on its heels. Their coalition is kind of under a lot of pressure from the right. And that's a huge problem. So I don't see in Europe these days any exemplar to look to as a leading light. And, you know, in fact, all you know, liberal democracies are struggling right now. You know, if you look at South Africa, for example, South Africa had an election recently in which the ANC still maintained a majority, but they had to go into coalition. You know, there's a lot of concern about the future of democracy in all this. We, you know, we have basically got wars that are, you know, sort of hard to imagine easy solutions to. And China and Russia and their friends are doing, you know, what they do best, which is persecute journalists like me.
That's investigative economist and attorney James Henry speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview is released on October 3rd, 2024.